The night air in Garden Grove, California, was still in the spring of 1984. Neon from a corner liquor store flickered against the quiet streets, and the hum of passing cars faded into the distance. In an upstairs apartment, 23-year-old Shannon Rose Lloyd closed her eyes for the last time. By dawn, her body would be found, and the city would never sleep the same way again. Shannon wasn't famous. She wasn't wealthy. She wasn't the kind of woman who made enemies. She worked, paid her bills, saw her friends, and lived her life in a way that should have kept her safe. But someone who knew how to get close, changed everything. The violence was brutal, deliberate. Detectives arriving at the scene spoke quietly, but their eyes said what no one wanted to hear. This wasn't random. In 1984, police had no DNA technology. They had fingerprints, witness statements, and instinct. And instinct told them this was personal. For weeks, detectives chased leads, but every trail went dark. Witnesses forgot details. Evidence degraded. Files piled up in an evidence room until the case became another unsolved folder in a cold metal cabinet. For Shannon's family, the silence was worse than the loss. Birthdays passed. Holidays came and went. Friends stopped asking. Her parents clung to the same photo. Shannon smiling under the California sun, because it was all they had left. Then, nearly four decades later, something shifted. A retired detective returned to the case, armed with tools that didn't exist in 1984. Evidence was tested again. This time, the results didn't fade into silence. This time, a name appeared. The suspect had been living in plain sight. This is the story of a city's sleepless nights, a family's decades-long fight for answers, and the science that caught a killer 37 years too late. It is about what happens when time doesn't erase the truth, only buries it until someone is willing to dig deep enough to find it. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave a comment. The next story might change your mind. Don't miss a single turn. Chapter 1. The Night in Garden Grove. Garden Grove, California. May 20th, 1984. I still remember the way the street looked that night, though I wasn't there in 1984. I've seen it so many times in photographs, old police video, and yellowed clippings that it feels like a memory. A narrow strip of asphalt, lined with modest apartment buildings. The kind of place where people keep their curtains drawn halfway. A streetlight burned out on the corner, leaving part of the block in shadow. The police photographer's flash lit it all up. The doorway, the stairwell, the window where a light never came on again. Shannon Rose Lloyd lived alone in a second-floor apartment on this street. She was 23. She worked at a local clothing store and was known for her warm laugh and the way she always remembered people's names. Her friends described her as steady, not the kind of person who jumped into drama. The few possessions she owned were neat and tidy. A coffee table stacked with magazines, a sofa she'd bought secondhand, and a framed picture of her with her parents in front of Disneyland. That Sunday night, Shannon came home from a quiet dinner with a friend. Nothing unusual. No frantic calls. No one followed her up the stairs. At least, that's what the surviving witnesses said. The police would later note there were no signs of forced entry, suggesting she either knew her killer or trusted them enough to open the door. The first call to police came at 6:48 a.m. on May 21, 1984. A neighbor, a woman in her late 50s, had knocked on Shannon's door to see if she wanted to share a cup of coffee before work. When there was no answer, the neighbor assumed she'd left early. It wasn't until another neighbor, a man delivering the newspaper, noticed Shannon's door ajar that concern began to spread. He peeked in and saw her lying motionless in the living room. By the time Garden Grove PD arrived, the scene was already compromised. Two neighbors had stepped inside, calling Shannon's name, leaving footprints and partial handprints on the carpet and furniture. One of them touched her shoulder, hoping she was unconscious. She wasn't. The medical examiner would later estimate her time of death between 10 p.m. and midnight. The crime scene photos show the apartment in eerie stillness. The coffee table had been pushed several inches off its usual spot. A lamp lay on its side, the bulb shattered. One of Shannon's earrings was found under the couch, as if it had been torn off. The signs of a struggle were subtle but undeniable. The cause of death, blunt force trauma, came from a single, decisive blow, followed by strangulation. Police believed it was over within minutes. Detective Robert Malley, one of the first on scene, later described the apartment as quiet but charged. He noticed an untouched plate of food in the kitchen sink. Pasta, now dried and cracking at the edges. There was a glass of red wine next to it, still half full. Whoever had killed Shannon either hadn't stayed long after, or they'd been careful to touch very little. The investigation began immediately. Officers canvassed the neighborhood, asking if anyone had heard anything unusual. One resident recalled a muffled thud around 11 p.m., but thought nothing of it. Another remembered seeing a man's silhouette near Shannon's window around 9 p.m., but couldn't describe his face. These scraps of memory would be all police had to work with in the early days. At the time, Garden Grove wasn't a high-crime city, but the murder sent a ripple of fear through the community. Women began locking their doors earlier. Parents warned their daughters not to walk alone after dark. Local news aired daily updates, replaying the same grainy exterior shot of Shannon's building over and over. The pressure on police was immediate and unrelenting. Evidence was collected carefully, for 1984 standards. Hair fibers, fingerprints, and a small swab from under Shannon's fingernails were logged and sealed. Without DNA technology, those samples sat in storage, their value limited to what could be matched visually or chemically. At the time, police pinned their hopes on fingerprints. But weeks later, when the analysis came back, none matched anyone in the state's database. What struck me most, going through the original case filed decades later, was the margin of error in every step. Witness statements contradicted each other. The neighbor who swore she saw a man near Shannon's window later admitted she'd been drinking that night. The man who found the door open changed his story about what time it was. And yet, the core fact, Shannon was killed in her home by someone she likely knew, never changed. The autopsy report paints the final clinical picture. A single head injury consistent with being struck by a blunt object, followed by manual strangulation. No defensive wounds beyond light bruising on her forearms, suggesting she was caught off guard. Toxicology showed no drugs or alcohol beyond the half glass of wine in her system. For the police, the case began here, with a young woman's life ended in a quiet apartment and a handful of clues that refused to speak. For me, this was the start of a question that would last 37 years. Who walked into Shannon's apartment that night, and why did they think they could get away with murder? Chapter 2, A City on Edge. When a murder happens in a small or mid-sized city, the first wave of impact is shock. The second is paranoia. By the summer of 1984, Garden Grove had both. The day after Shannon Rose Lloyd's death, the Orange County Register ran the headline. Young woman found dead in apartment, police suspect foul play. Below it was a black and white photo of Shannon taken from her driver's license. It was the kind of image that strips away personality, flat lighting, unsmiling, utilitarian. But for her family and friends, that photograph was an injustice in itself. Shannon had been vibrant, warm, and full of life, and now the public would only know her as the face in that tiny rectangle on the front page. The Garden Grove Police Department held a press conference that morning in the cramped basement of City Hall. The lead detective, Robert Malley, spoke for 3 minutes. He confirmed Shannon's name, her age, her address, and that her death was being treated as a homicide. When pressed by reporters for details about how she was killed, Malley shut it down. "We're not going to release specifics at this time." That refusal to give details only fueled speculation. Talk radio hosts guessed out loud whether this was the work of a stranger, a jealous boyfriend, or a serial predator. Local bartenders, barbers, and grocery store clerks swapped rumors that morphed with each telling. One version claimed Shannon had been stalked for weeks. Another claimed she'd been seen arguing with a man outside her apartment 2 nights before. None of it was confirmed, but all of it was repeated. I interviewed residents who were children back then. They remember their parents locking windows they'd always left open. People began to check their back seats before getting into cars. The phrase "don't walk alone after dark" became more than parental advice. It became a rule of survival. The city's population in 1984 was about 140,000. Most people worked blue-collar or service jobs. Crime rates were moderate, burglaries, car thefts, the occasional assault. A brutal murder in a young woman's home was different. It wasn't something people could write off as gang violence or a bad drug deal. This felt targeted, intimate, and that made it worse. By week two, the police presence was impossible to miss. Uniformed officers walked apartment complexes, stopping to chat with residents, asking if they'd seen anything unusual. Detectives went door to door with clipboards, taking statements that would later fill dozens of binders in the case file. Patrol cars circled slowly through neighborhoods, lights off but visible enough to remind everyone they were there. Not all of the community's attention was supportive. There was frustration, even anger, at the lack of progress. Flyers with Shannon's picture, this time a smiling snapshot her family provided, appeared on telephone poles and in shop windows. But with each passing day, fewer people stopped to read them. I found a surviving copy of a Los Angeles Times article from June 4, 1984. The headline read, 2 weeks later, no leads in Garden Grove slaying. The piece quoted a woman who lived in Shannon's building. We thought they'd have someone in custody by now. You can't tell me they don't have anything. Behind the scenes, detectives were chasing down every name that came up in interviews. Shannon's co-workers were questioned. Her landlord was questioned. Ex-boyfriends were located and interviewed, some more than once. All of them denied involvement, and none could be tied to the crime seen through the limited forensics available. Shannon's funeral was held on May 26th at a small Catholic church in Santa Ana. Nearly 200 people attended. The service was quiet, heavy with disbelief. Detectives attended in plain clothes, scanning the crowd. They watched for unusual behavior. Someone who wouldn't meet their eyes, someone crying too hard, someone not crying at all. They saw nothing that led anywhere. In neighborhoods far from Shannon's, the murder became a cautionary tale. A college student told me her mother started sleeping with a baseball bat by the bed. A grocery store cashier said she carried pepper spray for the first time. Even people who had never met Shannon felt exposed, vulnerable. The longer the investigation went without an arrest, the bolder the rumors became. There was talk of a suspect list pinned to a board in the police department, with a dozen names. Whether that was true or not, it kept the gossip alive. And while some neighbors avoided talking to police for fear of getting dragged into something, others called in constantly with tips, most of which went nowhere. One thing was certain. The city would never be the same after that May night. Garden Grove, for all its palm-lined streets and family-run businesses, now carried the weight of a murder that didn't fit into any neat box. The killer was still out there, and no one knew if, or when, he might strike again. By midsummer, the case had already begun to slip from front pages. Other stories took its place: a local election, a freeway expansion, a heat wave. But for Shannon's family, and for the detectives still working the case, the pressure only grew heavier. And as I would learn later, this pressure would play a dangerous role in what came next. An investigation that moved fast, maybe too fast, and began steering toward the wrong suspects. Chapter 3. The First Investigation. The first weeks after Shannon's murder were a blur for the Garden Grove Police Department. A mix of urgency, public scrutiny, and blind corners. From my review of the original case files, it was clear they were determined to catch the killer quickly. But determination doesn't guarantee accuracy. The official investigative timeline began on May 21, 1984, the morning her body was found. By noon that day, the lead detectives had compiled a preliminary suspect list. It wasn't long, just six names, but it included anyone who had been in Shannon's orbit within the past 6 months. They started with the ex-boyfriend. His name appeared in several of Shannon's friends' statements. They'd dated for a year, broken up 3 months earlier. According to her friends, there had been no major fights, no restraining orders, no late-night calls. But the detectives couldn't ignore him. When they brought him in for questioning, he came willingly. His alibi, dinner with his sister across town, was verified within 24 hours. The problem was that alibi ended around 10:30 p.m., and the medical examiner's time of death range stretched as late as midnight. They pressed him on whether he'd been near Shannon's apartment that night. He denied it. They asked if she'd ever seemed afraid of anyone. He said no. The interview notes reveal a telling line from Detective Malley. Doesn't seem nervous enough. In 1984, gut instinct often carried as much weight as hard evidence. Still, without fingerprints or a witness placing him at the scene, he was released. The next name was the upstairs neighbor, a man in his 40s who had been living in the building for about 2 years. He was the one who claimed to have seen a man's silhouette outside Shannon's window on the night of the murder. Detectives quickly realized his account had inconsistencies. At first, he said the figure was tall and wearing a hat. Later, he said it might have been medium height and bareheaded. When asked to describe where exactly he was when he saw this, he said he'd been on the balcony. The balcony, as the crime scene photos confirm, faced the opposite side of the building from Shannon's unit. The only way he could have seen her window was by leaning dangerously far over the railing. Detectives began to wonder if he was inventing the sighting to insert himself into the case. They checked his alibi. He'd been at home watching television alone. No corroboration. Then came the coworker. Shannon had worked with her at the clothing store. This woman claimed Shannon had recently complained about a customer who lingered too long and asked personal questions. The coworker described him as creepy and too interested in her life. Detectives took this seriously, interviewing the store manager and pulling sales records to try to identify him. Nothing panned out. The customer was never found, and the lead fizzled. By the third week, detectives were widening the net. They looked at a maintenance worker for the building, noting his master key could have opened Shannon's apartment without force. He denied any involvement and passed a polygraph test. In 1984, that carried weight. Today, we know polygraphs are unreliable, but back then, a pass could shift focus away from a suspect entirely. Perhaps the most frustrating dead end came from an anonymous tip line call on June 3rd. A man claimed to have overheard two people at a bar talking about the girl in Garden Grove. He said one of them mentioned she didn't see it coming and laughed. The caller refused to give his name. Detectives checked bars in the area, but came up with nothing. The tip was logged, then left to gather dust. Reading through the interviews, what stands out is how many people wanted to help, and how many seemed to enjoy the attention of being connected to a murder case, even loosely. False memories, embellishments, and outright fabrications tangled the investigation. Forensic evidence wasn't giving detectives much to work with either. The fingerprints collected from Shannon's apartment belonged mostly to her and known visitors. A few unidentified prints were found on the kitchen counter, but without a match in the state database, they were useless. The hair fibers collected from the crime scene were analyzed for color and texture, but without DNA, they could only narrow them down to dark brown, possibly male. Still, Detective Malley and his partner pushed forward. They conducted 57 interviews in the first month. They worked long days, often into the night, chasing down every possible lead. But by late June, the reality was setting in. They didn't have enough to arrest anyone. In my conversations with surviving members of the original investigative team, the frustration is still there. One retired officer told me, "We were working blind. We didn't have the tools, and every day that passed made it harder." Another said, "I still think about the ones we ruled out too fast. It's easy, in hindsight, to point to mistakes. But in the summer of 1984, they were doing what they could with what they had. And what they had wasn't much. Each lead faded. Each suspect was eliminated or left hanging without enough evidence." By July, the file on Shannon Rose Lloyd's murder was getting thick, but the space for primary suspect remained blank. That blank space would stay that way for decades. But before it did, the detectives would take one more shot, a last push before the case began to cool, a push that would prove both desperate and dangerous. Chapter 4, The Case Grows Cold. The turning point came quietly. There was no dramatic announcement, no press conference declaring failure. One day the detectives were working Shannon's case full-time, and the next, it was just another file in the stack. It was late summer 1984 when the momentum truly slowed. The early flood of tips had thinned to a trickle. The news coverage that had once run daily was now buried on page 5, if it appeared at all. Other crimes, newer, louder, more solvable, were taking priority. In the Garden Grove Police Department, the walls of the homicide unit told their own story. Each case had a whiteboard with names, times, and leads scrawled across it. Shannon's board had been crowded in May and June. By August, half the writing was erased. The rest had gone stale. The persons of interest list was now a list of people we talked to. The once promising theories had been crossed out with thick black marker. The decision to scale back wasn't malicious. It was practical. Detective Robert Malley was assigned a new homicide in September. A double shooting in a motel parking lot. His partner was pulled to work on a series of armed robberies. The unofficial message was clear. Unless something big breaks, this case is on hold. For Shannon's family, the change was devastating. Her mother, Patricia, kept a spiral notebook of every phone call with police. In the early days, there were daily updates. By the fall, the entries were weeks apart. On October 2nd, she wrote, "Detective says nothing new. Asked again about the wine glass. He says they're still waiting on the lab. The lab results, when they came, were useless. No fingerprints clear enough to match anyone outside the people already known to have been in the apartment. Evidence handling in 1984 was a different world. The murder weapon, if it existed, was never found. The hair fibers, fingernail scrapings, and clothing were stored in paper envelopes, sealed with tape, and labeled by hand. The storage facility was climate controlled, but not by today's standards. There were no tamper-proof barcodes, no digital chain of custody logs. Items were checked in and out with pen and paper. Years later, a forensic expert would tell me, it's a miracle the samples survived in usable condition. At the time, though, no one was thinking about decades. They were thinking about the next week, maybe the next month. In 1985, there was a brief flicker of renewed interest. A man in San Diego was arrested for a string of assaults that bore some similarities to Shannon's case. He targeted women in their homes, often entering without forced entry, and attacked late at night. Detectives compared notes, even drove down to interview him in person. He denied ever being in Garden Grove. Without DNA, they couldn't tie him to the crime scene. He was eventually convicted for the assaults in San Diego, but any link to Shannon was speculative at best. By 1986, the investigation was effectively dormant. It wasn't officially closed, homicides never are, but it had joined the growing list of cold cases that sat in storage, waiting for a break that might never come. The file was thick enough to fill a banker's box. On the side, written in black marker, were the words, Lloyd Shannon R. Homicide, May 21, 1984. That box would follow the department through three building moves over the next three decades. It would sit on shelves in evidence rooms and file archives, gathering dust but never disappearing entirely. For the family, the years that followed were measured not by milestones, but by absences. Birthdays, holidays, weddings. Each one was a reminder that Shannon wasn't there. Patricia called the police at least once a year, usually on the anniversary of her daughter's death. She was polite but persistent. Each year, the answer was the same, nothing new. The case's cold status also meant the rumors took on a life of their own. People whispered that the killer had moved away. Others said he was still in town, hiding in plain sight. Some believed the police knew who it was but couldn't prove it. Without answers, speculation became its own form of folklore. In 1990, a small article ran in the Orange County Register. 6 years later, no arrest in Garden Grove murder. It was a single column, with a grainy reprint of Shannon's smiling photo. The piece quoted Patricia, who said simply, "We're not giving up. We can't." By the time the 1990s ended, the world had changed. DNA was becoming a tool for solving crimes, but only in the most clear-cut cases, usually when biological evidence was fresh and abundant. Shannon's case didn't seem like a good candidate. The samples were old, minimal, and possibly contaminated. Testing them in those early days would have consumed all the material, with no guarantee of results. And so the box stayed sealed. When I first saw it, decades later, the tape was brittle, the handwriting fading. But it was all there. The photographs, the reports, the diagrams of the apartment, the tiny envelopes holding the evidence. At the time, I didn't know that those same envelopes would one day hold the key to solving the case. In 1984, they didn't have the science. In 1994, they didn't have the funding. And in 2004, they didn't have the will. But in 2021, all three would finally align. Until then, Shannon's murder was a wound the city learned to live with, quietly, painfully, and without closure. Chapter 5, New Tools, Old Wounds. The mid-1990s brought a quiet revolution to law enforcement. For the first time, detectives had a tool that could do what no witness, polygraph, or hunch ever could, DNA testing. It began making headlines in high-profile cases. In 1994, DNA helped convict O.J. Simpson in the court of public opinion long before a jury reached its controversial verdict. Around the same time, a man named Kirk Bloodsworth became the first American death row inmate to be exonerated by DNA evidence. These stories made the technology sound like magic, a perfect, unbreakable link between suspect and crime scene. Inside police departments, though, the reality was less glamorous. The tests were expensive, slow, and prone to failure if the evidence was degraded. and in a cold case like Shannon Rose Lloyd's, degradation was almost a given. I met retired forensic analyst Linda Carver in her small Orange County home. In the late 90s, she'd worked in one of the few California labs capable of processing DNA for criminal cases. She remembered when Shannon's file crossed her desk. Not for testing, but for review. It was 1998, she told me, flipping through her personal scrapbook of solved and unsolved cases. I saw the note that there were fingernail scrapings and some fibers. The problem was, back then, we needed a lot more material than we do now. If we tested it and failed, that was it. There'd be nothing left for future testing. So the decision was made to hold off. The evidence stayed in storage, still sealed in its original envelopes. It wasn't unusual. Departments all over the country were sitting on old cases, waiting for technology to catch up to their evidence. Meanwhile, DNA was making headlines for its role in solving other decades-old murders. A 1976 case in San Diego, a 1981 murder in San Francisco. Each success sent a jolt of hope through the families of other victims, including Shannon's. Her mother, Patricia, called the department after each one. "Can't you do the same for Shannon?" she'd ask. Each time, the answer was cautious. Maybe someday. Not yet. The 1990s were also the era of California's DNA database expansion. The state began collecting DNA from convicted felons and later from those merely arrested for certain crimes. The database grew, slowly at first, then exponentially. Detectives knew that even if they didn't have a suspect in mind, one could emerge if their DNA ended up in the system. But there was a darker side to the progress. Cold cases were being prioritized based on likelihood of success and public interest. Cases with famous victims or multiple unsolved killings got funding first. Shannon's case, tragic but quiet, with no other known linked crimes, often fell to the bottom of the list. In 2002, there was another close call. A detective new to the cold case unit pulled Shannon's file and submitted a request for partial DNA testing on the fingernail scrapings. The request made it through two layers of approval before being denied for budget reasons. The money went instead to a case with two child victims, which had a higher chance of yielding usable DNA. Patricia never knew about the denied request. She kept calling, every year, marking the anniversary with a fresh plea to look at it again. Her persistence became part of the case's unofficial timeline. Detectives knew the call was coming each May. Some took it as a reminder of their unfinished business. Others saw it as a burden they couldn't lift. By the late 2000s, the forensic landscape was shifting again. Newer testing methods, like STR, short tandem repeat, analysis, required less material and could produce results from older samples. Still, the backlog was immense. California's crime labs were drowning in requests. Shannon's case sat in line, year after year. When I asked retired Detective Malley about that period, he sighed. It wasn't that we didn't care. We did. But I had cases stacking up on my desk every week. Unless something came in that put her case back in the spotlight, it stayed where it was. And yet, even in limbo, the case wasn't entirely forgotten. In 2011, an evidence review team audited the department's cold cases. Shannon's was flagged as having viable biological evidence, a note that would prove critical years later. The review also confirmed that the envelopes containing the fingernail scrapings and fibers were intact, still bearing their original 1984 seals. That same year, another shift began, the rise of familial DNA searching. It was controversial, raising privacy concerns, but it also opened a door for cases like Shannon's. Even if the killer wasn't in the database, a relative might be. By 2015, technology had reached a point where the old samples could finally be tested without destroying them. But the process required a dedicated cold case unit to prioritize the work. Garden Grove didn't have one. What it did have, by then, was a new generation of detectives. People who had grown up with DNA as part of policing, who understood its potential. One of them, a detective named Karen Holt, first read Shannon's file in 2016. She told me she was struck by how solvable it seemed. You had preserved evidence. You had a crime scene with no forced entry. You had a victim who almost certainly knew her killer. That's not nothing. Still, Holt's request to test the DNA went nowhere. The lab backlog was still years long, and the city had more recent homicides to process. It wasn't until 2020, nearly 36 years after Shannon's murder, that the cold case unit was formally reactivated, with Holt at the helm. By then, technology had advanced to the point where even degraded samples could yield results. The tools that had once seemed out of reach were now standard. And in the middle of a pandemic, with crime rates shifting and budgets being reshuffled, Holt found her opening. The fingernail scrapings were sent to the lab in early 2021. 3 months later, the results came back. For the first time in 37 years, the name of a living suspect was linked to Shannon's murder. But before the arrest, before the headlines, there was the moment that changed everything. A quiet click of a mouse in a dim lab, and the appearance of a match that no one had expected.